a brief notice of the laws of two other states, and we shall pass on to other considerations. By the laws of New Hampshire, collected and finally passed in 1815, no one was permitted to be enrolled in the militia of the state but free white citizens. And the same provision is found in the subsequent collection of the laws made in 1855. Nothing could more strongly mark the entire repudiation of the African race. The alien is excluded because, being born in a foreign country, he cannot be a member of the community until he is naturalized. But why are the African race, born in the state, not permitted to share in one of the highest duties of the citizen? The answer is obvious. He is not, by the institutions and laws of the state, numbered among its people. He forms no part of the sovereignty of the state and is not, therefore, called on to uphold and defend it. Again, in 1822, Rhode Island, in its revised code, passed a law forbidding persons who were authorized to join persons in marriage from joining in marriage any white person with any Negro, Indian, or mulatto under the penalty of $200, and declaring all such marriages absolutely null and void. And the same law was again reenacted in its revised code of 1844. So that down to the last mentioned period, the strongest mark of inferiority and degradation was fastened upon the African race in that state. It would be impossible to enumerate and compress, in the space usually allotted to an opinion of a court, the various laws marking the condition of this race, which were passed from time to time after the Revolution, and before and since the adoption of the Constitution of the United States. In addition to those already referred to, it is sufficient to say that Chancellor Kent, whose accuracy and research no one will question, states in the sixth edition of his commentaries that no part of the country except Maine did the African race, in point of fact, participate equally with the whites in the exercise of civil and political rights. The legislation of the states therefore shows, in a manner not to be mistaken, the inferior and subject condition of that race at the time the Constitution was adopted and long afterwards throughout the 13 states by which that instrument was framed. And it is hardly consistent with the respect due to these states to suppose that they regarded at that time as fellow citizens and members of the sovereignty a class of beings whom they had thus stigmatized, whom, as we are bound out of respect to the state sovereignties, to assume they had deemed it just and necessary thus to stigmatize, and upon whom they had impressed such deep and enduring marks of inferiority and degradation, or that when they met in convention to form the Constitution, they looked upon them as a portion of their constituents, or designed to include them in the provisions so carefully inserted for the security and protection of the liberties and rights of their citizens. It cannot be supposed that they intended to secure to them the rights and privileges and rank in the new political body throughout the Union, which every one of them denied within the limits of its own dominion. More especially, it cannot be believed that the large slaveholding states regarded them as included in the word citizens, or would have consented to a constitution which might compel them to receive them in that character from another state. For if they were so received and entitled to the privileges and immunities of citizens, it would exempt them from the operation of the special laws and from the police regulations which they considered to be necessary for their own safety. It would give to persons of the Negro race who were recognized as citizens in any one state of the Union the right to ever enter every other state whenever they pleased, singly or in companies, without pass or passport and without obstruction, to sojourn there as long as they pleased, to go where they pleased at every hour of the day or night without molestation, unless they committed some violation of law for which a white man would be punished. And it would give them the full liberty of speech in public and in private upon all subjects upon which its own citizens might speak, to hold public meetings upon political affairs, and to keep and carry arms wherever they went. And all of this would be done in the face of the subject race of the same color, both free and slaves, and inevitably producing discontent and insubordination among them, and endangering the peace and safety of the state. It is impossible, it would seem, to believe that the great men of the slaveholding states, who took so large a share in framing the Constitution of the United States and exercised so much influence in procuring its adoption, could have been so forgetful or regardless of their own safety and the safety of those who trusted and confided in them. Besides, this want of foresight and care would have been utterly inconsistent with the caution displayed in providing for the admission of new members into this political family. For when they gave to the citizens of each state the privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states, they at the same time took from the several states the power of naturalization and confined that power exclusively to the federal government. No state was willing to permit another state to determine who should or should not be admitted as one of its citizens and entitled to demand equal rights and privileges with their own people within their own territories. The right of naturalization was therefore with one accord surrendered by the states and confided to the federal government. And this power granted to Congress to establish a uniform rule of naturalization is, by the well-understood meaning of the word, confined to persons born in a foreign country under a foreign government. It is not a power to raise to the rank of a citizen anyone born in the United States who from birth or parentage by the laws of the country belongs to an inferior and subordinate class. And when we find the states guarding themselves from the indiscreet or improper admission by other states of emigrants from other countries by giving the power exclusively to Congress, we cannot fail to see that they could never have left with the states a much more important power, that is, the power of transforming into citizens a numerous class of persons who in that character would be much more dangerous to the peace and safety of a large portion of the Union than the few foreigners one of the states might improperly naturalize. The Constitution upon its adoption obviously took from the states all power by any subsequent legislation to introduce as a citizen into the political family of the United States anyone, no matter where he was born or what might be his character or condition, and gave to Congress the power to confer this character upon those only who were born outside of the dominions of the United States. And no law of a state, therefore, passed since the Constitution was adopted, can give any right of citizenship outside of its own territory. A clause similar to the one in the Constitution, in relation to the rights and immunities of citizens of one state in the other states, was contained in the Articles of Confederation. But there is a difference of language which is worthy of note. The provision in the Articles of Confederation was that the free inhabitants of each of the states, paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives from justice excepted, should be entitled to all the privileges and immunities of free citizens in the several states. It will be observed that under this confederation, each state had the right to decide for itself and in its own tribunals whom it would acknowledge as a free inhabitant of another state. The term free inhabitant, in the generality of its terms, would certainly include one of the African race who had been manumitted. But no example, we think, can be found of his admission to all the privileges of citizenship in any state of the Union after these articles were formed and while they continued in force. And notwithstanding the generality of the words free inhabitants, it is very clear that according to their accepted meaning in that day, they did not include the African race, whether free or not. For the fifth section of the ninth article provides that Congress should have the power to agree upon the number of land forces to be raised and to make requisitions from each state for its quota in proportion to the number of white inhabitants in such state which requisition should be binding. Words could hardly have been used which more strongly mark the line of distinction between the citizen and the subject, the free and the subjugated races. The latter were not even counted when the inhabitants of a state were to be embodied in proportion to its numbers for the general defense. And it cannot for a moment be supposed that a class of persons thus separated and rejected from those who formed the sovereignty of the states were yet intended to be included under the words free inhabitants in the preceding article, to whom privileges and immunities were so carefully secured in every state. But although this clause of the Articles of Confederation is the same in principle with that inserted in the Constitution, yet the comprehensive word inhabitant, which might be construed to include an emancipated slave, is omitted, and the privilege is confined to citizens of the state. And this alteration in words would hardly have been made unless a different meaning was intended to be conveyed or a possible doubt removed. The just and fair inference is that as this privilege was about to be placed under the protection of the general government and the words expounded by its tribunals and all power in relation to it taken from the state and its courts, it was deemed prudent to describe with precision and caution the persons to whom this high privilege was given, and the word citizen was on that account substituted for the words free inhabitant. The word citizen excluded, and no doubt intended to exclude, foreigners who had not become citizens of some one of the states when the Constitution was adopted, and also every description of persons who were not fully recognized as citizens in the several states. This, upon any fair construction of the instruments to which we have referred, was evidently the object and purpose of this change of words. To all this mass of proof, we have still to add that Congress has repeatedly legislated upon the same construction of the Constitution that we have given. Three laws, two of which were passed almost immediately after the government went into operation, will be abundantly sufficient to show this. The first two are particularly worthy of notice because many of the men who assisted in framing the Constitution and took an active part in procuring its adoption were then in the halls of legislation and certainly understood what they meant when they used the words people of the United States and citizen in that well-considered instrument. The first of these acts is the naturalization law, which was passed at the second session of the first Congress, March 26, 1790, and confines the right of becoming citizens to aliens being free white persons. Now, the Constitution does not limit the power of Congress in this respect to white persons, and they may, if they think proper, authorize the naturalization of anyone of any color who was born under allegiance to another government. But the language of the law above quoted shows that citizenship at that time was perfectly understood to be confined to the white race, and that they alone constituted the sovereignty in the government. Congress might, as we before said, have authorized the naturalization of Indians because they were aliens and foreigners. But in their then untutored and savage state, no one would have thought of admitting them as citizens in a civilized community. And moreover, the atrocities they had but recently committed when they were the allies of Great Britain in the Revolutionary War were yet fresh in the recollection of the people of the United States, and they were even then guarding themselves against the threatened renewal of Indian hostilities. No one supposed then that any Indian would ask for or was capable of enjoying the privileges of an American citizen, and the word white was not used with any particular reference to them. Neither was it used with any reference to the African race imported into or born in this country, because Congress had no power to naturalize them, and therefore there was no necessity for using particular words to exclude them. It would seem to have been used merely because it followed out the line of division which the Constitution has drawn between the citizen race who formed and held the government and the African race, which they held in subjection and slavery and governed at their own pleasure. Another of the early laws of which we have spoken is the first militia law, which was passed in 1792 at the first session of the Second Congress. The language of this law is equally plain and significant with the one just mentioned. It directs that every free, able-bodied white male citizen shall be enrolled in the militia. The word white is evidently used to exclude the African race, and the word citizen to exclude unnaturalized foreigners, the latter forming no part of the sovereignty, owing it no allegiance, and therefore under no obligation to defend it. The African race, however, born in the country, did owe allegiance to the government, whether they were slave or free, but it is repudiated and rejected from the duties and obligations of citizenship in marked language. The third act to which we have alluded is even still more decisive. It was passed as late as 1813, and it provides that from and after the termination of the war in which the United States are now engaged with Great Britain, it shall not be lawful to employ on board of any public or private vessels of the United States any person or persons except citizens of the United States or persons of color, natives of the United States. Here the line of distinction is drawn in express words. Persons of color, in the judgment of Congress, were not included in the word citizens, and they are described as another and different class of persons and authorized to be employed if born in the United States. And even as late as 1820, in the charter to the city of Washington, the corporation is authorized to restrain and prohibit the nightly and other disorderly meetings of slaves, free Negroes, and mulattoes, thus associating them together in its legislation. And after prescribing the punishment that may be inflicted on the slaves, proceeds in the following words, and to punish such free Negroes and mulattoes by penalties not exceeding $20 for any one offense, and in case of the inability of any such free Negro or mulatto to pay any such penalty and cost thereon, to cause him or her to be confined to labor for any time not exceeding 6 calendar months. And in the subsequent part of the same section, the Act authorizes the corporation to proscribe the terms and conditions upon which free Negroes and mulattoes may reside in the city. This law, like the laws of the states, shows that this class of persons were governed by special legislation directed expressly to them and always connected with provisions for the government of slaves and not with those for the government of free white citizens. And after such a uniform course of legislation, as we have stated, by the colonies, by the states, and by Congress, running through a period of more than a century, it would seem that to call persons thus marked and stigmatized citizens of the United States, fellow citizens, a constituent part of the sovereignty, would be an abuse of terms and not calculated to exalt the character of an American citizen in the eyes of other nations.